Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
Welcome to episode number 13, the bad luck episode of the Tech and Loathing podcast. I want to start this episode off by giving a brief apology to anyone who's in the live stream tonight. You seem to hear an episode of Linux in the Ham Shack, which is not going to happen because something happened to my co-host today. He wouldn't tell me what it was. Apparently there's some kind of shitstorm, as he put it, at work. And whatever happened, it left him practically for dead. So as far as I know, he is in bed at this time. And so I've had to dig up some random co-hosts from other cardboard boxes in random places around the country. One of which is with us tonight via cell phone technology. And that would be Lord D. Welcome once again to the Tech and Loathing podcast, Lord D. How are you tonight?
Besides a little mayhem with my home networking setup, I'm alive and well.
A little mayhem with the home networking setup. What's that all about?
I made the mistake of deciding to try to put an LDAP system into place using my running NAS for free system instead of testing with a VM first. So it caused some issues with the permissions on the NAS Rebox.
Sounds like fun. Not. Again, welcome back. This is the second time you've been with us, and last time we talked about guns. Tonight we're actually going to talk about a tech subject. Well, a couple of tech subjects anyway, so stay tuned for that. But we have a new guest on the show tonight. His name is Kevin Wisher, also known as K. Wisher, or Quisher, if you prefer, on the IRC over at Pound Oddcast Planet. And we'd like to welcome Kevin into the show tonight, thank him for being here, and find out how he's doing. So how are you doing?
Doing good tonight, Russ. Thanks for the invite, and just happy to be here.
Excellent. Any home networking problems we should know about? Kill any hobos lately? You know, anything of interest you want to tell anybody?
No, my network's up and running pretty good right now. I'm like Lord D. Sometimes I like to play around with my stuff live too and do occasionally cause a breakage here and there, but tonight everything's good.
All right, that's excellent. I'm glad everybody's network is working fine. As a matter of fact, just before this show, I had to go up to where one of my servers is co-load and switch out a hard drive tray, because I managed to wind up getting the hard disk in before I got the hard drive tray in. So I had a little bit of jury-rigged hot swap hard drive action going on, involving some cardboard, rubber bands, and stuff like that, holding the hard drive in, and then I got the tray, so I actually put things together the way it should be. Now, to me, that's like hardcore tech. So, since that generated absolutely no response whatsoever, maybe we should just move on to the main topic, unless anyone has anything they want to bring up. Now, I know that Kevin has looked at the notes for the show tonight. Anything there that piques your fancy that you want to start with, or you just want me to run down the list, or what?
Just go ahead and get started, and I'll chime in when I have something to contribute to the topic.
All right. Well, as it happens, I think I'm going to skip the number one thing in the list, because I talked about that on the Linux in the Ham Shack that we did a week ago. That was episode 94, and I talked about that topic there. So people can go get that episode if they want to hear about creating a desktop image slideshow in GNOME. My first thing is a little bit of complaining to do about the Motorola Droid X and the Motorola Droid X2 and recent releases of Android. Now, do either of you happen to have an Android phone?
I'm currently coming through on a Samsung Galaxy S3 running CM10 stable, which happened to be released just this morning.
And what version of Android is that based on?
4.1.2.
Okay, so that would be an ice cream sandwich distro. And what about you, Kevin?
I'm currently using a Droid Razer Max, and I just look at it, and it's running version 4.04 with a stock ROM still from Motorola.
Okay, well, you two both have slightly newer phones than I have, apparently, and I just wanted to kind of rant about Android a little bit and where things are going with that, because I know Android is rather ubiquitous in the cell phone market these days, and it's on a lot of devices. It's an open source project, so that is excellent. You know, it's really hard to, you know, to argue with that kind of thinking for those of us who come to open source, you know, looking at it in a positive way. But the sort of fracturization, is that good?
I need to make a correction for you. I believe 4.0 is ICS and 4.1 is Jelly Bean.
Okay, good. Well, that's exactly what I'm getting to. You know, the inability to actually figure out what version is codenamed what is kind of part of my problem, but in a more generalized sense, because it in a typical Linux distribution, which Android is at its base, you have the kernel, you have the applications that run on top of it, and that's what makes Android Android. But Android has been so fractured because Google does weird things with it. They tend to do all of their development behind the scenes, then release their code after it's already been pushed out to all of the devices. And then they have developed hardware, or there have been hardware vendors that have developed hardware in conjunction with current versions of Android at the time the hardware is released, and then they don't bother to give them either specs or the time of day so that they can be upgraded to new versions of Android as they come out. Thereby, Kevin is using 4.04, which presumably is ICS, and Lord D is using 4.1, which is Jelly Bean. And of course, there have been one or two revisions that have either come out or are coming out very soon after that. But my Android phone, which is less than 2 years old, is currently running Gingerbread and cannot be upgraded because Motorola or Android, or not Android, I'm sorry, Motorola or Google can't be bothered to put out an updated release of Android for my handset. And I've got to say, this is frustrating as hell. So, not being a victim of this, do either of you want to comment on this sort of weirdness with Android and the sort of vendor lock-in you get with the handset you buy?
Well, the first thing I'll say is I've made the choice not to be a victim of that. I was pretty careful about choosing the phone I was going to buy when I bought the Galaxy S3, making sure I was going to get a phone that would be supported by CyanogenMod, moving away from the vendor's version of the ROM. I know there's some inherent risks that I take with that, but I've chosen not to be a victim in that whole vendors being very, very slow on updating their ROMs.
Okay, slow on updating their ROMs. I kind of gather from Motorola that this isn't a case of them being slow. This is a case of them not giving a crap, and there will never be an update anything past Gingerbread. But there's a problem there in that I can't get a new phone unless I go to a new contract or pay $600 or $700 or $800 for a handset. At the moment, I can't even get a new contract because my 21 months of my original contract aren't even up yet. So I'm basically screwed. And I'm not enjoying being there. So, Kevin, any thoughts?
Well, I just recently upgraded to this Droid Razer Max about a month and a half ago. I came from the original Droid, and I, you know, the Motorola is like you say, they're slow in getting their updates. So on the original Droid I had, the first smartphone I ever owned, after, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, I rooted and ROMed it and started running, you know, various different ROMs. I kind of settled on CyanogenMod for it. And I really haven't, on the new phone, I'm kind of waiting to see, since it's still still new. I'm not real in a real big hurry to root and roam it yet. Been doing my research, and when I don't see any updates coming for the Android, you know, coming down from Motorola for it, then I will take that step into, you know, rooting it and putting a custom ROM on it when they fail to provide, you know, me with the features that I think I should have from the company you buy the phone from.
And I think another thing we need to kind of be aware of here is that we're the tech crowd looking at this problem. My fiance, who's now running my older Samsung Galaxy Captivate, she really doesn't care what version of Android it is. A lot of the lay don't care as long as it works and works well for them. So I think we need to at least state that, you know, this may be more of an issue for the, you know, tech crowd who wants to play with newest, latest, greatest toys.
And I agree with you, Lord D, and I think that's kind of why the iPhone is, I hate to say it, is popular amongst the non-techie crowd. It's just something that, you know, they accept what they're given, and it works for them. It's simple to use, and it's just not for the geeks.
Well, let me interject here. Well, of course, I'm not really interjecting, but let me comment on both of your comments, because the problem that I'm having with my Android phone is that it's not working for me. My girlfriend also has a Droid X. She has the Droid X 2, which she got about a month after I got my Droid X. And both of us are having very bad problems with our phones, having to reboot all the time, having applications lock up, not being able to make calls, sound going away. And I've heard that a lot of these problems have been fixed in later versions of Android, but because of the, you know, supposed age of our handsets, even though they're less than 2 years old, we're still stuck with what I guess you consider a bad or a buggy version of Android. Can't upgrade them. I've actually looked at doing something like rooting them and going to CyanogenMod, but unfortunately, both of us decided to take Motorola firmware updates, and so our basebands are too new, and they haven't, over at CyanogenMod, apparently been able to crack the latest baseband so that we can roll back far enough in order to install CyanogenMod. So we are really stuck with the phones we have. It has actually pushed me to the point where I believe that both of us, when our contracts expire, are going to go back to iPhones. And that's a sad day in our world, but the iPhones just work, and we can't really deal with this anymore.
Well, a question I'll ask is, are you on a GSM or CDMA carrier?
I'm on Verizon, which is a CDMA carrier, so there is no swapping of SIM cards allowed, so to speak, because there are no SIM cards. We just have handsets with the CDMA circuitry built into them.
Now, with my new Droid Razr, the Razr Max, it actually has a SIM card, and I'm on Verizon.
Okay, so that's using, like, the 4G LTE, which apparently is a GSM-based technology?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, see, unfortunately, we're stuck in that place where everything is working against us. We have, it's like the Hurricane Sandy of phone problems right now. We're in a total superstorm of, you know, can't regress the baseband, can't update the firmware, can't root and put on CyanogenMod, can't get updates from the manufacturer, and so on and so forth, and can't get out of our contracts and switch to something else. You know, the point we're at is we'd have to pay $700 for a new handset, and obviously that's unacceptable for most people, including myself. That's why I'm frustrated right now.
Oh, I'm not trying to downplay your frustrations with Motorola at all, K5, but I really want to lay this problem directly in the hands of the manufacturers, and unfortunately, in the case of Motorola, it's kind of easier to lay that problem at the feet of Google, since they're now a Google subsidiary, but I still would put these problems at the feet of the handset manufacturers, and especially in the case of Verizon, Verizon as well.
Yeah, I mean, I see them all as culpable, at least in part. So that makes it even worse, because there's no place to focus blame. You have to kind of spread it around, and that dilutes the anger and the frustration. So it's just a bad situation all around, which kind of leads me into the next topic that I had, which is what Apple does right. And I sort of was leading into that based on my my frustration with Motorola on Android and so forth, and the idea that I might actually switch back to an iPhone. I think I've pretty much decided that I will switch back to an iPhone because of what Apple does right. Now, I think we all understand that Apple does a lot of things wrong, but what I'm seeing lately is that in the open source marketplace, and specifically in Google's marketplace, the idea of Android being open source is there, but it's not really free. It's not really free as in Libre, and it's definitely not free as in cost. I mean, these handsets are not cheap, and the only way you can really afford them is to get the subsidized contract price. So, yes, Apple does things wrong, but I think Google is doing things plenty wrong themselves, and I feel less and less guilty every day about going back to the Apple iPhone, just because I know that when I power the thing on and want to make a telephone call or surf the web, I'm going to be able to do that. And I can't do that. Can't be confident of doing that on a daily basis with my Android. And I got to tell you, that's incredibly frustrating.
Well, unfortunately, you being over on the CDMA line of things, at least as it stands, the Nexus is not an option for you. And I think Google is now going a long way with the Nexus 7, the Nexus 4. I don't know about the Nexus 10. I haven't seen prices on that. They're going a long way to changing the price for an unlocked Android device.
To the tune of what? I mean, what do you... I assume you're saying that they're coming down to a reasonable price for an unlocked device. What would you consider reasonable for said device?
Well, the Nexus 4 handset runs, I believe, about $300 US, and the Nexus 7 tablet is $200 US.
Yeah, I would consider that reasonable, and I would certainly consider switching carriers in order to be able to have that technology. I assume that AT&T and I'm not sure which of the other carriers are based on GSM technology. One thing that sort of helped us out in Verizon's case is with AT&T, they allowed you to upgrade your phone after only half of your contract was up. In Verizon's case, it's 18 months, which means I only have to wait 6 months more, and then I can just get out of the thing altogether and go to a different carrier. So I may consider that as well.
So you switch to an iPhone, you don't think you'll fall into the trap that Apple, I feel like this trap where they come out with a new phone every 6 months and everybody rushes out to get it. And so, you know, you're still going to be stuck with a phone for the length of your contract. So is that going to be a problem when the next version of the iPhone comes out and you're stuck with a model that's going to be 2 years old before you can get a new one?
Well, the thing is, there's another piece of this puzzle that hasn't been discussed yet, which is that before I had an Android phone, I had an iPhone. I actually, my very first smartphone was an iPhone 3. Then I upgraded to the iPhone 3GS. I actually upgraded to the iPhone 3G, but the 3GS came out a week later. But I was lucky enough when I was still with AT&T that I went into the, you know, the store when the iPhone 3GS came out and said, you know, me and the thousands of other people, probably millions of other people, and said, you know, I just bought this thing and the 3GS just came out. And they said, oh, you know, we'll give you a 3GS. It won't cost you anything, blah, blah, blah. So I didn't get screwed on the short release cycle of Apple hardware. But the thing is, even for the two phones that I had from Apple, I was happy with them every day. I could rely on them. It's not that they were perfect, because they did glitch every now and then. But when I look and compare them to the Motorola Droid, they were unbelievably sound. And, you know, the sort of hardware lock-in that Apple does, it's annoying when you think about it, because everything they do is locked down. Everything they do is so proprietary, so closed, so anti what we all think is the better way to go. But by doing that, they make everything stable. They make everything reliable. And like I said, it's not perfect, but then electronics in general aren't perfect. But when I compare the two, and I think going back to the iPod is the way to go, I still think it's the way to go, because I know that if I stick with Android, I'll probably wind up with like a Galaxy S3, you know, something along those lines. And yeah, it'll probably be a decent user experience and I'll probably be fine with it and all that. But I know what I had before and I just think I'll enjoy it more. But the enjoying it more than an Android is not really the determining factor. The determining factor is now I feel that Apple and Google are on even footing when it comes to their sort of overarching evilness. So it doesn't matter to me which one I pick because they both suck. So I feel like I just should go back to Apple and be happy.
So your overall deciding factor is the perceived stability of an Apple device over the crap, which is what Motorola has put out on you.
Well, that's certainly what I'm looking at right now, and it's not a perception. It's actual evidence. I have, you know, I have actual cited evidence of how well my iPhone 3GS performed and how crappily my Droid X has performed over the roughly 2 years that I had both. And there's no question in my mind that going back to the iPhone will make me a much happier person. Well, since everybody's been driven off by that comment, I guess we should probably move on to the real topic of the evening, unless someone else wants to bash me once again for mentioning Apple in the context of open source and anything else that we all believe is good, before I move on to remote desktop protocols.
Well, I'm going to have to apologize at this point, but something's come up and I need to bow out at this point in the evening, gentlemen.
Not a problem whatsoever. Lord D, thank you once again for your thoughts and comments on the show so far. Hope you have a good evening.
Thank you, K5, and have a good evening, and same to you, K-Dub.
Talk to you later, Lord D.
Okay, so let's get off of that ridiculous topic. I've probably ranted on it way too much than I should have anyway. I wanted to talk a little bit about remote desktop protocols because not that long ago, I was using an X-based application called TS Client on my Linux Mint and my Debian machines to connect to RDP servers and VNC servers, you know, when I needed to do remote administration or things along those lines. Well, it turns out that in some of the more recent releases of those distributions, the TS client has gone away. It's no longer available in the repositories. Now, this may or may not be a problem for you in whatever distribution you're using, but it happens to be a problem for me. So I was looking for an alternative. Well, the alternative I found is an application called Remina or Remina. Is this something you're familiar with, Kay Wisher?
Yes, it is. I'm a network administrator at a local K-12 school system, and I'm fortunate enough to where my main system that I use is running, right now I'm running Solus OS, which is based on Debian stable, and I administer all my Linux servers using Remina. I don't know exact pronunciation of it, but I find it very useful. I can remote into any of my Windows servers, Linux. I don't really have any. I've got Linux servers, but they're none. They're all, you know, just servers. They're not. Don't have any GUIs on them. And then we've got a couple of Mac Mini servers that I also can connect with this same client.
Yeah, that's excellent. I mean, you basically do with it the same thing that I do with it. It turns out that, you know, on our network, there are several Windows machines that have to be administered. Now, Remina, doesn't have to be used for Windows boxes, but it turns out that it's very useful to me for that purpose because it supports the RDP or the remote desktop protocol. Now, this is a Microsoft protocol. Terminal services boxes use it, and it happens to be, you know, sometimes Microsoft actually does things correctly. And RDP happens to be one of those things that they've done correctly. It's a very good remote desktop client. It's very efficient. It's highly compressed. And even over relatively slow networks, you have to connect to a server that is serving its desktop using RDP. Its responsiveness is very good. Now, I'm comparing this specifically to things like VNC, which the compression tends to be not so good in, and doesn't perform quite as well, especially over slow network connections. Is this something you've noticed as well? Because, I mean, it really seems prevalent to me that RDP is a very efficient remote desktop protocol.
I'll agree there. I've really never used any other client. I have tried, like, tight VNC, but I find Remina just is an all-purpose client. And something I don't know if you're aware of, and I just became aware of it here in the last month, is that you can actually use it as an SSH client just like PuTTY.
Yes, there's actually, if you go into the configuration, there is an SSH tab, and you can actually use it for SSH tunneling and transporting your desktop sessions encrypted on the wire, which is a great added feature, but it's something that I in particular don't really use because I have a separate administrative LAN that is entirely off the internet when I go to these remote desktop sites. So I'm not typically worried about encryption. The other problem with encryption is it increases overhead. And of course, responsiveness will go down if you use encryption, but to have that as a feature is an excellent part of the application.
I've never used it for connecting from home to my network because we have a Cisco ASA firewall, and I'll have to connect ENC to it and then use a window, since Cisco, they do provide Linux and Mac clients, but I've never have had any luck with them. So if I do happen to have to remote in from home into our network, I have to use a Windows machine to run the Cisco VNC client.
Okay. Well, in my environment, I don't use a Cisco ASA. I actually have a Linux machine running as a firewall and a router box using OpenSwan for IPsec VPNs. And, you know, any protocol works fine over that because the whole tunnel is already encrypted using IPsec. And so I don't have to worry about what's going over it. So it sort of eliminates a step in worrying about encryption for me.
But I noticed that lag when I'm connecting from home, you know, through the firewall and then getting in, you know, getting into the internal network. It's nice that the way it works, because it's like I'm sitting at work when I'm tunneled in that way, but I definitely notice a little lag coming, you know, even though I've got a cable internet speed at home, and it is definitely laggy.
Yeah, understood. And, you know, typically you're over like a DSL or a cable connection, which it doesn't have its, you know, full bandwidth available full time. And of course, you're going to experience lag and slowdowns and all that kind of thing. So the nice thing for me about Remina is that before Remina, before I found it, and after I sort of lost the ability to use TS client, I was using GNOME-RDP. Now, this is an RDP client, too, and it does work. But the real problem with it is if you want to set it up, it's set up in a sort of tiered configuration structure. Now, I get the tiered configuration structure because there are other databases and other data sets that I use that are built this way. But basically, what you have to do is you have to say, I have this group of servers, and you define that group of servers, and then you say, I want to define a certain connection type, and that can be VNC or RDP. And then you have to say, I want to configure an authentication type, whether it's RDP authentication or local authentication or whatever. And then you have to link all of those pieces together to create a client definition where you say that I want to connect to this server using this protocol with this authentication type at this IP address. And then link all of those things together and call it, you know, server name or whatever. And to me, that's a lot of configuration steps to just do a remote desktop into a remote machine. With Remina, you don't have to do any of that stuff. Basically, unless you want to get down into the nuts and bolts of it and configure it to your total, you know, satisfaction, where you can set arbitrary screen size, bandwidth limits, and I can't even remember all the options you can configure inside Remina. It's a very large number. But at the root of it, if you just want to connect to a remote desktop client, you fire up Remina, you type in the name of the server or its IP address, click OK, and you're in. That's all there is to it. You authenticate locally with whatever server it is. Typically for me, it's a Windows box where you log in as administrator, whatever the local administrator password is, and you're done. You have an RDP session. To me, that makes Remina incredibly useful, super easy to configure. And then basically you can save that configuration. And if you want to change some of the settings, like you want to use scale mode or full screen mode or a different bit depth, you know, color depth or log or a different protocol or any of those things, you can just save it and fix that stuff later. Whereas in order to even get a session started with GNOME-RDP, you have to set up all that stuff first, which to me is really annoying. So, does this match your view of that, or do you have a, you know, sort of a different idea of it?
No, I agree totally. It's very, very easy. Like I say, it's very simple. You just put in the IP or the server name and connect. And if you don't like what you see, you can configure the screen, you know, the screen resolution, and all the, and you can even save your password if you want, if you're, you know, don't worry too much about security. And when you save those settings, it all saves in a dot, in your home folder, in a dot Remina folder. And so you can back that folder up if you ever decide to wipe your machine, and you can get all your, you can restore that folder back and be back and going in a, you know, a short order of time. So it's really slick. Like I said earlier, I'm connecting to Windows machines and also connecting to Mac machines with it. It works really great.
Yeah, that's excellent. I haven't actually used it to connect to a Mac OS machine, but I'm going to give that a try just because I want to do it. But connecting from a Linux machine to a Windows machine has been so super easy that I have just been blown away by Remina, and I can't recommend it enough to anybody who has to do this, even if it's only on a, you know, an occasional basis. It's just such a great program. You know, I believe it's in all of the repositories. Of course, I use pretty much Debian repositories. It's a simple apt-get install Remina away, and that's Remina, R-E-M-M-I-N-A, by the way. Let me go ahead and let Kevin make any more comments he wants to about this while I find the URL for the application.
Another feature, I mean, this is not just exclusive to Remina, but, you know, I have at any time during my workday, I may have, you know, four sessions opened up in the main window, and they're all tabbed across the top. And to switch between the servers, you know, it's just a simple click of the tab, and you're into whatever server you need to be, just real lickety split. So, and I leave that running, you know, logged into all my Windows servers all the time. So, I mean, even over the weekend when I'm not there, my box is pretty fairly secure. It's a Linux. Like I say, it's Linux. I'm not too scared of anybody. I don't even, my boss didn't even know my password to log into my machine. So I just leave that up running, you know, all the time. And I can, of course, the main machine server I'm logged into all the time is our main AD server, and then our Exchange server, and sometimes the print server, and a file server. And then occasionally, like I say, I have to log into a couple Mac Mini servers.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't even gotten to the point where I've had to use it multi-tabbed, because basically I kind of leave the Windows machines alone as much as I can, but sometimes I just have to pop into one, do some random, you know, administrative function, and I'm sort of done with it. For that, Remina is just so awesome. Bill in the chat room, who is our normal Linux in the Ham Shack keeper of all knowledge, has switched over and been very helpful in the Tech and Loathing podcast tonight. Found the URL for Remina, which is remina.sourceforge.net. You can find out all the information you need to about the application there. Download it from there if you need to. But of course, I imagine it's in every repository and every distribution out there in the world right now. So if you don't actually need the information, just go ahead and use your Yum or your Yast or your apt-get or Pac-Man or whatever it is you use, and go ahead and install Remina. I can't recommend it enough. And I believe it also supports VNC. Now, I haven't actually used it for VNC, but I'm pretty sure it does.
In fact, yes, when I connect to the Mac servers, that you have to use. You have to use the VNC part, the protocol.
Yeah, so there you go. It even supports VNC. Now, GNOME RDP also supports VNC. It supports RDP. It supports RDP version 5. And like I say, if you if you sort of have the mindset where you like to be very organized, where you want to set up, you know, each tier of your configuration and then use GNOME RDP to connect to those, it's a good application. It really is. It just takes a little longer to set up. Once you do that, building, you know, future connections is really easy because you already have the, foundations built. So building on top of that foundation goes quickly and you can add stuff later. But to me, it's a little more work than is really necessary just to make a simple remote desktop connection to a remote box. So use it if you want to, but I'd say go ahead and use Remina.
Another, I don't know if I want to call it RDP because I know RDP is the Windows protocol, but here at home when I want to have a graphical remote into my other Linux boxes from Linux to Linux, I use a called Vinagre, V-I-N-A-G-R-E, and it works kind of similar to Remina, but you can go from Linux to Linux and use the built-in, you know, I don't know what protocol Linux, what protocol does Linux use from for Linux to Linux.
My understanding is it's pretty much VNC if you're talking about serving remote desktop. Or, of course, there's a straight E connection. I mean, you can get a straight X server connection as well.
Right. Try if you got two Linux boxes at home that you want to play around with, try that Vinagre. It reminds me a lot of the Remina, but it works pretty good for going from Linux to Linux. And I just need it occasionally here at home to remote into my Myth TV boxes.
Okay, that's one I haven't heard of, and Bill, of course, keeper of all knowledge, has given us the URL for it, and it's projects.gnome.org/Vinagre, V-I-N-A-G-R-E. So if you want to check out that, go ahead and do that. Also, as far as doing Linux to Linux remote desktop, like I said, you can have a raw X connection to a remote desktop that's running an X server. The problem with this is it's a raw connection. It is straight data connection over X, the X protocol, and that is highly bandwidth intensive. So unless you're on a local area network, it's going to be very, very slow. And if you're doing a Linux to Linux remote desktop, you're going to want to use a different protocol. You're going to want to use VNC or Vinagre or something else. And one thing that I've recently discovered is a project called XRDP. Now, what this thing does, to me, is super clever. What it allows you to do is you do an apt-get install XRDP, or a yum, or a yast, or a pacman, or wherever, I assume it's in all the distributions repos. You install it, and then when it starts up, creates an RDP shim running on port 3389, which is a front end to a VNC backend. So basically what happens is there's a little bit of a shell application that sits in front of VNC on a local server and presents an RDP interface out to the network. So when something connects to this box, whether it be a Windows Terminal Server client or Mac OS X running the Windows Terminal Server client or using Remina, for example, on a Linux machine, it will connect to a remote Linux server as if it were using the RDP, the remote desktop protocol, the Microsoft one, connects on that port. And then what it does is it shunts that connection across the loopback to a local VNC server. So you get the advantages of running RDP across the network and VNC across a local connection, which basically has unlimited speed inside the local machine. So you get the performance of RDP using VNC, and you can connect to it a Linux machine from any client that understands RDP. This is super awesome. Everybody should install XRDP on their machine. Make sure you secure it properly, but you should definitely use this thing. Have you seen this before?
Never have. In fact, this is the first time I've heard of it.
Yeah, well, you should definitely try this out. I was looking for some way to connect to my Linux box using something other than VNC or an SSH, you know, connection, or a straight up X session. And XRDP came up in my Google search. I tried it. It was in the repositories. I installed it. I went from my Mac OS box, from a Windows machine, and from a Linux machine running Remina to a remote Linux machine using RDP, the RDP protocol, because it's totally fronted by this little, you know, RDP shim even though it's VNC running in the background, and it works perfectly. It gives you a brand new X desktop, loads, you know, whatever your local desktop environment is, and it does it not with the native performance of RDP, but with certainly better performance than VNC, SSH, or a raw X connection. It was super nice, and I, you know, and like Remina, I can't recommend this thing enough. If you need remote connection to a Linux box, definitely check out XRDP, which, by the way, you can find at www.xrdp.org. Let's see. Do they have anything more? Is Etherpad got anything else in it? It does. Yeah, it sure does. It's got a couple of things more that I should probably talk about. First being VNC, which is sort of what we've talked about here. There's a couple, I mean, there used to be, I think, what, 6 or 7 versions of VNC out there, but the two that seem to have stuck around through the years or whatever are Real VNC, which tends to be a little Windows-centric, a little Microsoft-centric, and then there's Tight VNC, which tends to be a little more prevalent in the Linux arena. Now, these are great clients and protocols. They're in the repositories. You can use them for connecting, you know, via remote desktop, not using RDP. They use their own protocol, VNC protocol. The only problem with these is, compared to RDP, they tend to be less compressed and slower. If you're on a local area network, this isn't really an issue. But if you're going over a DSL or, you know, a satellite or a cable connection, you may find performance severely degraded using VNC, and you may want to opt for some of the other RDP options we've already talked. Anything you want to comment about VNC? Because I don't think there's really anything to say about VNC. I think RDP is just better overall, so I don't want to waste too much time on it.
Yeah, I agree. I've used them in a pinch. I used, I think, the Tight VNC a couple times in a pinch from a Windows. I think when we just got our first Mac Mini servers this summer, and I needed a way to get connected to them through a Windows box, and when you do a quick Google on how to, you know, VNC into a Mac from a Windows box, you know, Tight VNC and Real VNC are probably your first, you know, a couple hits on Google. So I tried Tight VNC for a brief period of time and haven't really used it since.
I'm sort of in that same boat. I mean, I've just been so used to using RDP that when I have to endure a VNC connection, that's just very frustrating. Kind of like my problem with Android earlier. But in the realm of RDP for Macintosh, if you're running Mac OS X, there is a Windows RDP client. You can just do a Google for it, you know, Google for RDP and Mac OS, and it'll give you a Windows site where you can download an RDP client written by Microsoft, and you can connect to any server that's running an RDP server or a terminal services server. This includes a Linux box running XRDP. So if you need to connect to a Linux machine from a Mac OS machine or to a Windows box running terminal services, you can do that with this client. Of course, it's not open source, but it is free as in beer. So there's a good option there, you know, if you don't care about your immortal soul or free software. Trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to touch on. Oh, there's something that's not really on the list here. One of the other ways you can connect to a server that might be of interest to people, particularly in a Linux to Linux, and maybe exclusively in a Linux to Linux environment. But let's say you wanted to run an application on a remote Linux server, but didn't want to have to start up the entire desktop environment just to run a single application. Well, you can connect an X server application from a remote Xbox, I shouldn't say Xbox, from a remote Linux machine running X to your local machine, because X can transfer the video data across an SSH connection. And all you have to do to get that to work in a typical situation where you have your X defaults file set up and you have SSH on your remote machine set up to allow incoming SSH connections, is you can do an SSH space dash capital C capital X space name of a server space and then an application name. And what this will do is it will tunnel an X connection from the remote machine back to your local machine through SSH, so that connection is encrypted, and it will run the application you specify on the remote machine, but it will display the output of that application on your local machine. You know, I've done this many times where I've wanted to run like Audacity on a local machine so I can like just bring up an Audacity project and export a FLAC file, but I'm not actually at home where that file exists. Or if you want to run a remote copy of Firefox, or I don't know, there's a million things that I can think of and a million more that I can't, why you might want to do this. Now, the two options that I gave you, the dash X is to allow the remote tunneling of the X connection, and the capital C is for a compressed connection. And the idea of that is that the data passing over that SSH tunnel is compressed, therefore you get a little bit of a speed improvement or a performance improvement across that SSH. Pretty much works with anything. Sometimes you'll get a few bizarre errors, like, you know, you'll get something like it can't load a library, or it can't connect to Dbus, or something like that. But it typically should still work, and you should be able to see that remote application locally on your X server. So usually when I describe these kind of technical things, I leave something out, but does that make any kind of sense to you, or is there something I've forgotten about?
I've never had to do this personally. I've read about it, and it's always tried to think of a situation where I could use it, but I just never have. I've never tried it. It sounds interesting.
Yeah, I've used it in several instances where, you know, there's an application that's running on a remote machine where the output of that machine happens to be, or the output of that application happens to be an X app. So the display is something you need to be able to see. It's not like a CLI application or something that runs under ncurses. So you actually have to be able to see the output, the X output of the application. And using the SSH dash capital C capital X option is a great way to do that. And I haven't found a situation yet where it doesn't work. So maybe something to consider. You can certainly check the man pages for like details on it, but it does work. And if anyone has a specific question about it, I'm going to give my email information at the end of the show, and you know, feel free to contact me. So I think I'm about ready to wrap up here, unless you've got anything you want to comment on.
No, I think we've covered everything I can think of. The only other thing, I mean, it doesn't actually encompass the RDP protocol, but you know, there's always SSH. You gotta love SSH and into from Linux to Linux.
Yeah, the thing about SSH though is that it is an entirely separate topic and something for another show. So I think we're gonna leave that one alone for tonight. Just wanted to let people know that there is a way to tunnel a desktop using SSH. If we want to talk about all the ways you can use SSH, that's about 13 episodes all by itself.
Very true.
All right, well, with that, I think we're going to wrap up episode number 13, the unlucky episode of the Tech and Loathing podcast. I'd like to thank Lord D for his contribution to our show early on. He had to step out. But you can find him typically over at IRC at Freenode on the Ash Ogcast Planet channel. If you're looking for Lord D, I can't remember his email address off the top of my head, and maybe he doesn't want me to give it out anyway. So we'd still have Kevin Wisher in here. I want to thank you for stopping by, being a first-time guest on the Tech and Loathing podcast. It's great to have you here. Is there any information you want to give about yourself, who you are, where you are, if you can be contacted, or do you just want to become a hermit like some of us do?
I'm generally on the IRC, like I say, in the Ogcast Planet channel, the Linux Basics channel. You can catch me on, sometimes I contribute on the Linux Basics podcast on Friday evenings. Plan on doing some HPR shows here in the coming months, maybe around the Christmas break time when I get a little more free time. So I don't want to give out my email address at this time. So no reason. If anybody wants to contact me, they can find me on IRC.
That's right. They have your name, and with Google Maps, they can probably find out where you are at any time of day anyway.
Sure, probably can. And I don't do Twitter. I don't do any of the social media. I do hang out on, I do have a Google Plus account, so if you want to hit me up there sometime, I'm sure you can find me there.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And I guess I'm going to go ahead and sign off and say, this is Russ, K5TUX. saying apologies once again for those listening, thinking they were going to get Linux in the Ham Shack, but you did get a show. There are still people listening on the live stream. Thanks everybody who stopped by the chat room. Really appreciate seeing everybody in there, and thanks to Bill for being his usual very informative self for the evening. That's Bill K9WKA. You can find him at the Linux in the Ham Shack website if you are so inclined. My name is Russ. You can email me at k5tux@techandloathing.info or russ@techandloathing.info. Of course, information about the show is at techandloathing.info. You can go over there, check out all our past episodes, find the feed, leave us a comment on the website. One of these days I may actually even put up a place for people to call in and, leave a voicemail and all that kind of stuff. Trying to actually put out the show a little more regularly, so hope everybody enjoyed it. Really appreciate all of our listeners, and we should be back in a couple of weeks or so with episode number 14. So with that, I'm going to sign out. Tech and Loathing number 13 is officially closed, and we'll see you all next time.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.